Harriet Geiselman. We have a regimental number, H6534. Lance Corporal. Joined the Grenadiers in September 1939, more or less by a matter of impulse than anything, that chum of mine happened to be over at the house one night and got talking about the war had just started and figured we were going to have to join sooner or later. He had been down and joined the Grenadiers that day, so he said, why don't you join the Grenadiers? It's a machine gun battalion, there could be lots of action, lots of excitement. Okay, why not? So next day I went down and joined them. As simple as that. There was no great idea of patriotism or anything from that point of view. And again, a good deal of it was financial because depression left us in bad shape, and I felt more or less responsible for somehow taking care of my mother and the younger kids in the family.
You weren't married?
Well, I was only 19 at the time. And my father had drowned that summer. So, a good part of my thinking, no doubt, was, well, here's a way to get a few bucks and have a little action at the same time, and I go on with it. The only thing is that I often thought afterwards that I kind of goofed it because I had been down a couple of months previous and taken an exam in the Air Force as a photographer. And instead of waiting around to get called up there, I got impatient as a kid and went and joined the machine gun battalion.
Did you ever find out afterwards that you would have been accepted or not?
I think probably I would because I had made a passing mark and without any trouble either. The photograph of it would have been as much of a hobby as you could follow a hobby in those days.
What about your training? Did you get much training in Winnipeg before you went to Jamaica?
Yeah, our training, I would say, of the battalion at that point was as good as it could be with the equipment that was available. Remember, we had no trucks and very few machine guns, but they were well backed up with a good gang of NCOs from the old militia battalion.
And then off to Jamaica, I guess.
Yeah. Actually, that was a good deal on the whole. The first few months I was there, I didn't think too much of it because this business of just guarding the internment camp seemed pretty boring. But I was able to get out of that and work in as a cook in the sergeant's mess. So I had far more freedom and pretty much on my own as far as being able to get out at night and so on. And we had no trouble making civilian friends. We could go to parties every night of the week if we felt up to it.
Do you remember how many strong the unit was in Jamaica? How many men were there?
No, not to be accurate.
When you came back to Winnipeg, the idea was to beef up the regiment, was it not?
Yeah, well, we did pick up quite a few reinforcements here to bring it up to full wartime strength, but just how many that would be, I don't know, it was a few hundred, but I don't know exactly.
Were you expecting European duty when you came back, or?
We had no idea. We didn't really expect European. A lot of the rumor was North African, which a lot of the boys were hoping for, I think. I was. I don't know just why. But
that was, I guess, at that time, that's where the
that's where the only action was burning. Yeah. And what it sounded like a good setup for a, what was in those days a heavy machine gun battalion.
What was your feeling when you found out? You didn't find out until you were on board ship that you were going to Hong Kong.
Well, we didn't find out actually until we landed. There was never any official notification of where you're going in the wartime army. You're simply designated as was it White Horse or something. White Horse, I think they called it.
Were you expecting, or was the, sort of the general attitude apprehensive about war coming in Hong Kong when you got there, or was it?
Well, there was a pretty good idea that something was going to happen, all right, because some of the officers during parade and training on board ship would make the statement that you guys better take this seriously. You may have to get off this ship fighting to get ashore. So then the thing was totally blacked out at night, of course. And what armament there was on the ship was, I think, one little 3-inch cannon on the back, plus machine gun posts up on the forward deck, kind of well set up, supposedly against aircraft. And of course, as young fellows, we were get up on these little reinforced concrete machine gun posts. We were hoping that some airplane would come at us, so just a little action, not realizing, of course, exactly what an airplane can do to a ship. But there was no, as I say, no official notification of anything that was going on. There never is
in wartime.
In wartime, in a situation like that.
Did you get along with the people from Hong Kong, the native people there, before the fighting started? Did they treat you fairly well?
Well,
were they hostile about it?
Oh no, no, they were. Canadian Army has a very good reputation, particularly where they follow the old British peacetime army. First of all, their spending power is about 5 times as much. Even in those days, at a dollar a day, it was still far above the British soldiers' shilling a day or whatever they got. So from that point of view, they're happy to see it. And then wherever we went, like in Jamaica at first, the first few weeks, there was some friction with civilians, but not much. And once they realized that, on the whole, the Canadians weren't out just to direct the joint and cause trouble and stuff, right? We were welcoming probably 95% of the civilian homes. Mm-hmm. And any other public place, I mean, there's almost nothing out of bounds to us the way there had been to the British enlisted troops.
I've heard that that in Hong Kong there's a lot of Japanese infiltrators in Hong Kong before the fighting started. Were you aware of that, or could Canadians tell Japanese from Chinese at that time?
I doubt it. Not very many of us, but none that I know of. And infiltration, as we know so much about it now, you never heard of it very much. Either you had heard of the term spies, and you knew there were spies around, but no, I've never never bothered us or never occurred to us one way or the other much.
Can you give me sort of a brief description of how the, however long you want, how the battle started and what you were doing during the battle and how it came out for you?
Well, the first inkling I had of it is the company I was in was over on the island, supposedly on trading maneuvers. And I had been posted to guard a water reservoir because there's no lakes or anything, and all the fresh water is a series of reservoirs and viaducts down from the hills down into the city. And I had been posted to guard this reservoir. So I was standing, it was a nice bright day in the sunshine, I was standing, there's nothing to do, nobody bothering me, standing looking around watching the birds and not really expecting any more bored than anything else. And from, I don't even know from where, this airplane came down and let go two, three bombs and smashed this reservoir, knocked me over backwards and got showered with dirt and gravel and crap. So I began to think this is a little serious type of maneuvers we're on here. Well then, it wasn't too long before we were told that we're now at war with these guys. But there never seemed to be any, there was no official publication or no big announcement, and all of a sudden you're at war and that's it.
Was it close contact, or was there ever a point where there was fixed bayonets?
There probably were, although I didn't actually see it. Almost everything I got involved in was straight rifle and machine gun work, because it was more a type of guerrilla warfare than there were no fixed lines or anything. Wherever they got ashore and started shooting at us, you shot back. And we weren't well enough aware of who was who or what was what. Somebody shot at you, you returned the fire. Now it's about the extent of it.
What kind of weapons were you using at that point?
About all we had were with some old Vickers, not very many, rifles and a few Bren guns. There was some artillery there, but most of it was pointed out to sea and didn't have any weight, so that didn't do us any good. And there was one, either battalion or part battalion of Indian troops with a little bit of mountain houses, but I never saw them in action, so just what good they did, I don't know.
Do you remember what battalion you were, or what platoon you were in, or company you were in, during the fighting?
At that time, I'd been transferred to headquarters company, supposedly as a transport driver. So we'd been, the first real fighting as such that I got into is another chap that I'd been sent downtown to commandeer a truck. And we had to take the platoon into action that night, which was a little bit scary because I wasn't much of a truck driver really, had no training in it. And this was an old British Bedford with about 17 gears that I knew nothing about. You couldn't use any headlights and mountain roads, so it was a bit, I guess it was all the guys on the back didn't know that how little I knew about driving the thing. And we had been told to take and hold a thing called Jardine's Lookout, I believe it was, our particular platoon. So we had no trouble taking it because there was nobody there. And so we got up into position, and the lookout, there was nobody there, so we deployed around a little bit. And they shifted us out of their aircraft and these little dinky mountain houses they had. So we lost, I think there were four or five of us managed to get out of it. There was a lieutenant cadet or cat in charge of the platoon. And he got pretty well shot up. And finally said, well, there's only three or four of us left, we better try and get out of there. So the only way we could get out without being caught in direct fire was down a creek bed or water course that went pretty well straight down the side of the hill. And we get halfway down that, and a company of Royal Scots was on the road at the bottom of it. First thing you know, they're shooting back up at us. By the time we got a handkerchief on a stick and waved it around and hollered in English, they finally quit shooting, and we got down and told them what had happened. And I remember the mate, who was a major in charge, oh, don't worry, everybody, he says, we'll have him out of there by morning. Which, of course, they didn't. There was no way. There was just too many of them all over the island, and no way you could do very much about it. So we got out of there, and one of the chaps had been pretty well shot up in the foot. We got him into the nearest hospital, and then reported back to our own company headquarters.
Where was that at that time? Where was your company headquarters?
Was that some right up on the where are we here? Was that hotel right up on the top of the or near a hotel right up on top of the hill?
Is that Layton Hill or Mount Cameron? I guess it came in Mount
Cameron. Pretty well straight up above the city somewhere.
Is that where you were when the thing was open?
Well, actually, what was the game? The whole surrender and everything wasn't cut and dried anywhere like it might be what you think normal warfare is. That we had been fighting a rear guard near Wan Chai Gap in an old house to try and get the Royal Scots down off the hill on the other side of the gully. Again, we didn't really know who we were shooting at, but we did manage to pick up through binoculars where they were setting up small howitzer, mortar positions. And we had a lot of fun there for a little while because we could watch through binoculars, one of the boys would pick up a Bren gun and scatter him, and the other guy would direct fire. It was more or less like rabbit shooting as far as that goes. But they must have had some more of these blasted mortars somewhere, because the first thing we knew, they had a direct bearing on the house we were in and leveled it pretty good, so we had to get out of there. Reported to up to the university, I think it was. Let me see if I get this straight now. So anyway, I remember we were up at this university or near it and got word that the general who was in charge had packed in and to report down to the police headquarters in Victoria. Well, it was an English, a Scotch fellow and I were together at the time, found our way down there, because you just kind of wandering around haphazardly. You didn't know, you know, ID, you've never seen a map of it or anything like that. You didn't really know where you were. But found our way down to this police headquarters, and there was a lieutenant or a captain of police. And we got talking to him. He was a matter of Dickens. He was just human that they had packed in. So we got together with him and see, well, what's the point of all this? We proceeded to get pretty well stewed on whatever beer and scotch and stuff we could find in the police officer's mess. And I don't even remember where we slept now. But we woke up in the morning and reported back to this police headquarters, and then we had to march back up as a blasted tramline to, well, if you've ever seen a picture of that, it was just a series of steps. It was to clean up the side of a mountain.
And that would be a Mount Cameron, maybe?
But it's the tram line straight up from Victoria to Mount Cameron.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know it was a long way up that tram line. So, we reported up there. There was a bunch of Canadians got together there. And they were, then they got orders for everybody to report to was another school or hotel or something. So a friend of mine was a sergeant Winwood, and I got left to turn this blasted university over to the to the Japs. Well, that was a real eerie experience. We didn't know what was going on. So we were sitting in, the two of us on a bench, kind of goggle-eyed, and these fellows that we'd been fighting for a couple of weeks were just marching four abreast through those doors and up the stairs behind us. Nobody paid any attention to us, and we just sat there. We didn't know how do you turn a university over to the enemy. We'd never been involved in that before. So, sat there, and these people, all scraggly and camouflaged and grubby and innocent as we were, just kept marching up. It seemed there were hundreds of them. I don't know how many there actually were, but an awful lot of them. So, finally, one of them came down. I presume he was an NCO, and grabbed Buzz Wingham by the arm and hauled him off upstairs. So I was sitting all alone watching these guys. Meantime, about six or eight of them had circled into this little alcove where this seat was. And I'm getting a little bit windy. These guys all sit and stare at me. You can't say hello. You can't say that. Don't know the language. So, need a cigarette pretty badly. And all the cigarettes I had was a part of one of these round tins of players. So, they were all going to be friendly with these guys anyhow. So I offered one of them a cigarette. Takes the whole can, which I didn't realize, but that was protocol with them. If you offer them something, that's what you're offering, the whole deal. Instead of one cigarette. So, well, and then I grab his wrist and take the can back again. And he up on his feet and out banned it, and I figured, oh, well, that was a mistake. And so I got to do something about this quick, because I didn't want to lose the last cigarette I had. I didn't want to get stuck with a bayonet particularly either. I take a couple of the cigarettes out of the can and hand them to them. And then do the same with the other four or five that were around, and everybody was peaceful. So about then I hear a deuce of a crash going on upstairs. And what's happened to Buzz now? What have they done with him? Couldn't go anywhere until I found out. There was no way I could find out. So I sat for a few minutes and finally Buzz came down the stairs again and said, what the hell was going on up there? And it appears that one of the doors had been left open, or left locked, rather. And they were trying to tell him in sign language to open it. Well, he had no keys or anything. So finally they hear, well, that room may be booby-trapped or something. So they, in sign language, they told him to kick it down. And Buzz said he never thought anybody could kick down a big, heavy oak door like that. But he backed up a few steps and drove at one and broke the lock loose. So they grabbed him and took him in and made him walk all around the room and move everything and make sure it wasn't booby-trapped. And then he came on down, so we heard, well, I guess we turned the thing over to him as far as we can see. So we left. But to get where the rest of our own people were meant walking down this road down the side of the mountain. And these Japanese infantry were lined up on both sides of this road. As far as you could see, it must have been half a mile from. And no lights, of course, but it was a bright moonlight night. All we could see was these infantry on each side of the road with fixed bayonets and the whole bit. And the two of us, the lonely buzzers, marching down the road between us. But we were happy enough to get back to our own guys and see what was going on.
Must have been a pretty harrowing experience at the time, though, like, well, being surrounded by that many people and not knowing what to expect.
Well, we had no idea what to expect. All we knew is they weren't friends, for sure, because we'd been supposedly fighting them for the last 2 weeks. And no idea, we'd heard all kinds of wild stories of what these people would do and everything. But there wasn't actually one of them that bothered us in any way. So then we got back to our own people at this other, must have been a hotel. And from there we were moved into what had been a Chinese refugee camp on the island. And we stayed there maybe 2 months or something.
Is this North Point?
Yeah, North Point camp, that was it. And then we were moved from there over to Shamshipo. Well, I was there for about another 15 or 16 months, and then went up to Japan.
When you were first captured, did you sort of expect it to be a temporary thing? You were going to be interred there for a few months and then get home, or were you expecting a long internment at that point?
Well, we had no idea, but we couldn't see. The biggest surprise through the whole thing was what was taking the Americans so long to beat these, to win this war. For the first few months, of course, we expected old Chiang Kai-shek to come over the hills on his white horse. And there were rumors every day of how much closer he was, and so on. But of course, nothing ever came of that. But we sure had no idea it was going to last for going on 4 years.
How was the treatment for you in North Point and in Shamshipo?
For me personally, it wasn't that bad because when I was in Jamaica, I had gotten to be a cook. So naturally, I was doing cooking whatever there was in both North Point and Shamshipo. Well, in North Point, I was cooking in one of the regular so-called messes. There was no equipment as such, whatever. Cooking equipment we had to go either find it or make it or something. And over at North Point it was a little better because it had been set up as a barracks, so there was a little better kitchen equipment there. And I was cooking for as a kind of specialized cook, but a lot of the fellows were coming down with dysentery and and did theory and one DNI. So I was put on as a special diets coach and do whatever you could to try and help these sick guys out.
Was there much you could do?
Oh, surprisingly, you could do quite a bit with a little imagination, like you can make soup out of the skeleton of a fish and the head of a fish and so on. And I don't imagine deer would be a very tasty soup, but compared to what they were getting there, they could at least get it down and keep it down.
Was there gardening there when you were there in Chapchapal?
No. You mean like growing our own vegetables? No, none of that.
So you were totally reliant on the Japanese.
Whatever they brought in through the gates, that's what we got. Well, up to that point, most of it was from the warehouses or godowns, as they call them, around the from the city itself.
And then when you went to Japan, like, did they sort of commandeer people, or did you volunteer, or what was the?
Well, in my case, I volunteered, and in fact, had a bit of a discussion with this Indian medical major. That he didn't want me to go because he wanted me to stay there and give him a hand to these fellows that were sick, but I had enough of that. I figured, bitch, in your own home country, it's got to be better than this. And besides, I was sick of that life. So I volunteered. But everybody else was pretty much commandeered, but yet the medical you had to pass is there was a wide road ran down the middle of the camp, and they lined everybody up, and those that could walk from one side of the road to the other were fit to go, so they loaded them on the ship and away they went.
Was the treatment better in Japan?
Oh no, it was much worse.
It was worse?
Oh yeah. Because there we were working, I imagine, about 12 hours a day, 364 days a year. The only day off was Christmas Day that they recognized. And there, where we were, it was a pretty cold stretch of country because it's only, I think, about 400 miles from Vladivostok, way up on the northwest coast. And we didn't have food or clothing for that climate or that heavy work.
Do you remember the name of the camp that you were at? What they called it?
There was never any name to the camp that I know of. It was in the city called Niigata. But there were a number of camps there because we were moved at least three times.
And were you cooking there too, or did they give you other things?
No. I was the first year and a half, I was just working in the steel foundry. But then at one point I came down with pneumonia that knocked me out pretty good. Well, I never really did regain strength from that, I guess. And after another 6 or 8 months, then at one point I developed an abscess on a leg that just about did me in. And that I remember pretty well because it had to be open because there was an abscess on my leg here that was as big as a football. I guess caused by a bruise or something right in along the bone. But there was no medical equipment as such. So the only way we could do anything was this chap from the American Medical Corps had a scalpel that they'd been using for sharpening pencils and stuff around. We sharpened it up as best we could, and he just had to open it up. And we stripped the insulation off a hunk of electric wire as a draining tube. And eventually, it got everything. Well, then I was back to work for another 3 or 6 months after that. And then my legs just played out, I couldn't walk anymore.
Did you have to go on half rations when you didn't work?
No.
Reduced rations?
No, there was never any change that I was aware of.
Were you aware that the Americans were bombing? Like, were you aware of the atom bomb when it was dropped?
We were, but an atom bomb, the term didn't mean anything to us. Because we had heard no discussion. What's an atom bomb? It's just a bomb is a bomb. And this city we were in, as near as I can gather, was the third one that would have got it if they hadn't quit. So a large part of the civilian population had been evacuated and they were all ready to get an atom bomb. But we were happy as a climber because we figured, boy, now they're going to really show these guys a little something.
You weren't worried for your own life?
Well, no, because we had no idea what an atom bomb could do. We just figured it's a big bomb. And our camp was probably a mile outside of the major part of the city. But there had been quite a bit of action previous to that for, well, night after night, these B-29s would go over and sowing mines in the harbor and so on. And one day there was a flight of Mustangs, I guess, from one of the American task forces came and bombed, strafed, and raised Cain with the harbor. So we knew the thing was getting closer. And then when they dropped all these leaflets advising them to evacuate the city, that they were really going to drop a bomb. Well, none of us could interpret Japanese accurately enough that we knew what an atom bomb was or what effect it would have. And so all it meant to us was this was going to end the thing. Hooray, let it rip.
So it must have been an incredible boost in morale to know that it was finally happening. It was finally going to be over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because they were, as I say, dropping, sowing mines in the harbor every night from quite often from B-29s and so on. So we knew that they were getting right back to their home territory, that it couldn't last that much longer.
Were the Americans the first people you saw? The first Allied forces you saw after the surrender came?
Well, what happened in our camp that we got notice that they had packed in, and this American major that was the Allied highest officer in our camp finally got fed up waiting for instructions from anybody, and he took a train and went down to Tokyo to find out what the devil was going on. And he came back and we all just got on the train and went down to Tokyo.
Did they just leave the guards that were there?
No, the guards stayed there more or less as a buffer between us and the civilians. Like, we were free to come and go because another chap and I were both on crutches, spent 2 days wandering the city, and we'd get into a so-called Japanese restaurant, and the money we could get easily. There was a camp of Koreans next door who had been forced labor, I presume, but they had been paid too, so they had all kinds of money. So you could always go over there and sell a blanket or a souvenir or anything and raise a few dollars to go downtown and buy a meal or go to a show or whatever. And then also, by this time, the Americans were dropping supplies in unlimited quantities. They would come over with their heavy bombers, and they mostly what they had was 2 55-gallon drums welded end to end with a big chute on filled with supplies, and they'd kick that out of them.
Getting, I just want to go back a little bit. Like, what kind of things did you do to keep your morale up while you were in camp? Did you?
Well, it was practically nothing amongst the Canadians. The only ones that really got together as a gang and did anything morale boosting were a few Americans that wound up there from this outfit that had been, well, first they were in Greece and Crete and got pretty well shot up, and then they made it over to North Africa. They were on their way back to Australia and they got as far as Java and Sumatra, and they were fighting, they got tangled with the Japs there. Then whatever was left of them were up working on this railroad in Burma. And then they left there by ship to come up to Japan, and they got torpedoed either once or twice before they got to Japan. So by the time they actually got to where we were, as far as they knew, there was only, I think it was 10 of them left out of a battalion of 2,000. Whether there were more scattered back along the trail, they didn't know, but that, to their knowledge, that was about it.
How long were they in?
Well, they were there about the last 6 or 8 months, I guess.
But they must have looked.
They were the finest morale of any gang of fellows I ever knew in my life. But they'd get together and kind of sing songs and the happiest clams, regardless of what was going on.
Did the Japanese try to do anything to keep, I mean, if you were working for them, you must have been valuable to them. Did they do anything to try and keep you going?
No.
Keep you?
No. That part of it, they had very little or any respect for a weakling at all. Like this march of a mile or a mile and a half or whatever it was from the camp to the found we were working in. Well, it became a heavy snowfall. Like there, the second one we were there, there would be nothing to have 3 feet of fresh snow on the ground when we woke up in the morning. Which meant that somebody had to break trail through it. And they were just the strongest of the prisoners would go first. And if you flaked out, they'd just leave you flaked out in the snow and pick you up on the way back. They would know. They weren't greatly concerned about our morale altogether. As a group, there were possibly one or two individuals that were a little more compassionate, a little more interested, but there was nothing they could do.
Did you learn Japanese? Or enough to get by on while you were there? Or?
Oh yeah, you learned enough nouns and verbs that between a combination of a few words and sign language, you could more or less carry on a conversation.
You have interpreters as well?
Boy, yeah, there's always members of the Japanese Army that acted as interpreters.
When, after the, when we had again after the surrender came, were things pretty much in a turmoil, or did they kind of get you all together? Or did they try to keep you together or just get you out as they could?
They didn't seem to be concerned about it one way or the other, as near as I could make out. They weren't. There was no effort on the part of the Japanese to bother with us one way or the other. The only way we got out of there so rapidly was that this American major went down to Tokyo. And made arrangements for us to go down there. I don't know how he got space on his train, whether he commandeered it or whether he got orders or what, I don't know. But we went down to, well, actually to Tokyo and then by the little electric train to Yokohama and were put on an American hospital ship there. So the ones that were immobilized, the fellows that couldn't walk were the first ones they got out of there. And as it happened, I was in good enough physical shape, except I couldn't walk, that they figured I could stand the flight home. So I was, well, I was actually the first Allied soldier to land back in North America. Like I was on the first plane load that landed back in San Francisco. And as it happened, I was nearest the door, so I was the first off. But they were absolutely marvelous. You asked for the moon, and I would imagine they'd done their best to get it for you one way or another.
Did you go to San Francisco and then Victoria, or just straight?
We went to San Francisco. There were three of us Canadians there. And they put us on a train in a compartment then up to Vancouver. And we were there for two or three days and then back train back to Winnipeg.
You mentioned earlier that there was had to be a cordon of police to keep the people back when you get off the train in Winnipeg.
Yeah, well, I imagine there must have been advance notice that we were arriving that day, because at that point, of course, the first few home, it was a big deal after 4 years. And our folks knew we were okay, all right, because we were given, as soon as we landed in Frisco, they set up a special switchboard in the hospital. And they cleared all lines anywhere in North America for the fellows to phone home.
How about when you were in Japan? Did you get letters out at all, or were they aware of your?
We were allowed to write letters, but as near as I can remember, none of them ever arrived home, and I never received any.
So for the 4 years, you were just totally cut off from.
Yeah, the only word my family had at all was that they had word that I was a prisoner of war, and that was it. So they must have gotten some kind of a list of who was still alive at that point.
Were there dignitaries out to meet you, or just civilian people to you?
Or in Winnipeg?
Yeah.
I rather imagine there were dignitaries, but it's a little bit, the whole thing's a little bit vague at this moment. It was, a lot happening all at once. I know there were in San Francisco, of course, there were all kinds of dignitaries. There were four-star generals all over the field and the whole bit, bands playing and I don't know what else.
After the fact, how long did it take before you were back to a civilian again after you got home?
Well, I got home in September, October, but I wasn't released out of the Army until spring.
And did you get a pension at that point? Or?
Yeah, I did. It was instituted almost immediately because of the physical shape I was in. My eyesight isn't that good. And pneumonia, I suppose, scarred and jiggered up my lungs to a certain extent.
Well, that's all the questions we've got to ask. If there's anything you want to add, if there's anything that we've forgotten that you think is important, you're obliged if you could bring it up. If you can't, that's fine.
Well, what kind of things, like?
Well, just if there's anything, any sort of personal things that you remember that are just interesting to you, or you think might be interesting to us, just sort of on a personal level.
Well, there were things that stick in your mind, and actually after this many years, the humorous things tend to stick more so than the unpleasant things. There was one incident of, like I said, these B-29s were sowing mines in the harbor. It happens that one night they missed the harbor, and one of these blamed mines landed right in front of the Japanese guardhouse in our camp. and a three-quarter breed itself in the sand. And they were a big mite, maybe, oh, as I remember, maybe 3 or 3.5 feet in diameter and 8 or 9 feet long, with a little bit of a parachute to control them. And then they had some kind of a mechanism in them that once they were in the water for so long, they became active. And this Japanese sergeant who was in charge of the guard at that particular time was a pretty good aide. So he was all around camp the next morning bragging how he whipped out of the guard house and cut the parachute off this thing for a souvenir. Because the NCOs all were, or a lot of them, if they came from the old warrior families, were allowed to wear these samurai swords. And he was quite proud of this sword of his and how sharp it was and how to whip this parachute off the thing. But then there were 2 or 3 of us that he had talked to in this so-called hospital room a little more because he had more time with us. So when he finished telling us about it, as he was going out the door, he turned and had the sheepishly his first show me his horses, which means, in other words, he crapped himself a little bit. He had cut the parachute off the thing for a souvenir. And within 24 hours, that thing was melted down in the foundry for scrap. So they were efficient that way, aren't they? Was something else? Oh yeah, the one of all these supplies they dropped, the one thing that sticks in my mind and affects, like, I imagine a lot of the fellows more than anything, was DDT, which is something we never heard of. But we've been plagued for the full 2 years we were there during the summer with these cursed sand fleas. And these huts we were in were just loose board floors with a woven mat on the floor, and that's it, period. And these blasted sand fleas would get in there, and there was no way you could not get all chewed up by them all night. So one morning, or one night, one of the fellows got hold of his cans marked DDT, and it was set on it, and they were American supplies, so it said what bugs it would kill, and so on. So he figured he was going to get even with these sand fleas. So we dumped about 3 cans of this stuff inside one of the tarps that they'd been dropping supplies in, wrapped himself in that, and first good night's sleep he'd had since he'd been there. He woke up in the morning and this thing was just full of dead sand fleas. There must have been a 100 or 150 of them in there. So we called some of the other fellows over and looked at them. All these little buggers are all dead. And a bunch of them were hunched around this hunk of camp, just killing themselves laughing. That was the biggest joke they'd ever seen in their lives, I think, was to see all these dead sand fleas. They finally got even with some of them.
Yeah, a lot of the boys talk about the flea situation.
Oh, fleas and lice, that was the true.
Was there rats in your camp? In Champshapui, I know there was, they had, it was really infested with rats.
Yeah, well, there, of course, the worst I remember seeing there was the tortoise were right down on the seawall. And you used to have to walk from whatever hut you were in over to these toilets at night. And these rats were big, big, mangy, ugly looking things with patches of fur missing and real ugly rats. And as big as a small cat, I guess. And I remember one night walking down to this toilet and looking out through the electrified fence over what had been the harbor, and it was low water. And there was the bloated corpse of a Chinese with his hands still tied behind him, and about 6 or 8 of these rats chomping on him. Well, after I got home for months, every now and again, I had nightmares about these cursed rats. They were big, ugly things. But the ones up in Japan were just like rats here. And in fact, some of the fellows made slingshots, and they used to go shoot them and cook them up. They figured if they were living on the same, on our grub, then we'd fairly get even with them and eat them.
Did you get any Red Cross parcels in Japan when you were there?
Yeah, about maybe three times there was a ship that came in, but there was no such thing as a parcel for men. There would be a parcel amongst five or a parcel amongst eight, and that's about as far as it got. It was a bit of a morale booster, but not really enough to...
Not enough to improve your health anymore?
No, I didn't really do that much.